Welcome to The Forum on 90.5 WCBE. Every week we bring you the conversations that are shaping Columbus, straight from the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday networking luncheons downtown. The Forum is where leaders, thinkers, and community voices like yours come together to unpack the issues that matter most to Central Ohio. Want to be part of the conversation? You can join us in person. Tickets and details about upcoming forums are available at columbusmetroclub.org. In Columbus, Black-owned braiding salons are places of entrepreneurship, cultural preservation, and community connection. Inspired by the Contemporary Theater of Ohio's upcoming performances of Jaja's African Hair Braiding, this week's forum explores the cultural and economic significance of African hair braiding and the stories woven into every style. Jaja's African Hair Braiding, written by Ohio State graduate Jocelyn Bio, follows West African women building lives inside a Harlem salon. Our panelists this week unpack how hair carries history, artistry, and identity. This week we welcomed Ohio State House Representative Juanita Brent, Sarai Brooks, braid artist, author, and owner of Haven 626 by Rye Styles, J. Avery Frost, executive director of the Central Ohio African American Chamber of Commerce, and Dr. Treva B. Lindsay, professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at The Ohio State University. Your host is LaChandra Baker, founder and lead consultant with LaChandra B. Baker Edutainment. Let's dive into this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, Braids, Business, and Belonging, Black Hair and Identity in Columbus.
Well, good morning, afternoon, and evening to whoever's listening, because the live stream is worldwide, because I'm a global phenom. So good to see you all. Thank you all for being here with us today. As Sophia said, I'm Law Baker, but I also have the honor and privilege of being the title character, Jaja, in Jaja's African Hair Braiding. So I would absolutely love to have you all in the audience participating with us. And this panel is going to help kick it off, because there's a lot of beautiful themes that is in this production, but it's really about identity, about culture, and sharing all the beauty that is within us on the outside as well. So I'm so grateful for all of you to be here and to be a part of this conversation with this illustrious panel. So I have a question. When we think about hair in this particular play, it is not just decoration. It is about language, it's about memory, and it's about economics, because let's get with it. The hair business is trillions of dollars. But are we always pocketing that money? Ooh, let me talk about it. Oh, she said it. Yes, she did. So Dr. Lindsay, from your lens, both as a scholar of Black expressive culture, how does Black hair function as both archive and resistance?
All right, we just jumping right in today. Okay, Law. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, everybody watching and in attendance here. I am struck by what we can ascertain from Black hair. And I mean that as an archive in and of itself of where we've been. It is a connection to diaspora. It is a connection to a political sense of self. It is a radical act, and by radical here, I mean getting at the root of, and so literally our roots are traceable, as well as our roots, our R-O-U-T-E-S, where we've traveled, styles that travel among us, how we think about ourselves, how we demarcate times and periods where we were unable to care for our hair in the way that we wanted to, the ways that we found subversion and fugitivity in the ways that we practice different hair things, the ways it's passed down between generations. I think of intimate moments with members of my family and doing my hair, greasing my scalp. Ooh, yes, the hot comb, the hot burning comb on it there, morning. Right? My just for me days, my lock days, all of these different processes that bind you to these incredible traditions of the ways that we engage with one another. And I think we don't often get to talk about the intimacy of those practices and the interior lives of Black folks. And those interior lives are where so much incredible intellectual thought, radical thought, expressive thought, joyous thought, angered thought, rageful thought, so much of that is happening in the spaces where we actually get to care for ourselves and then adorn ourselves and put on the mask, the warrior that goes out into the world that in many ways was not built for us, but we keep building. And so the hair carries those memories, it carries those traditions, but it also carries our futures with it as well. Our futures of intimacy, our futures of joy, our futures of rebellion, they're all contained in our locks.
I love that so much, because I think about, yes, please, do give it up. I mean, this sister bad. Y'all should hear her talk all the time. She has a wonderful, wonderful podcast about feminism. It's beautiful. But when you think about just even how messages were weaved into our, like, our scalp, the design of braids told stories. And I love that you said the intimacy of it, because it was hidden to people who didn't understand the culture. And I think a lot of times, as we think about right now, when we are expressing ourselves, we could say something or a glance or a look that is so intuitive, and we know what we're talking about. And not everybody's been invited to the cookout. So when you think about that, like, how do we continue to show up and show ourselves and who we are as a culture without having to over-explain these things? So I'm gonna ask you that, and then I wanna ask Avery the same question.
So I just don't, right? That's one way of thinking about this. But there is an intentionality to that kind of illegibility. So much of what we think about is the demand to be visible, to be seen, for our full humanity to be recognized and accepted. But part of that question for me always pivots back to accepted by whom? And what is the kind of recognition that we want? I love that there are glances, gestures, movements, certain things that will be unintelligible to other folks, that I'm not going to explain, that you can't go to Urban Dictionary or any other site and figure out, because the subversive notes of Black existence are really important for refuge. They're really important for resistance. Mm-hmm. They're really important for when we want to build the next thing, when we want to invest in creativity and be as innovative and as genius as Black can be. And I think that does require a lack of explication. There are many times where I love explaining, here are these histories, look at this archive, look at the history of Black entrepreneurs, and look how Black hair in particular build and can build wealth within communities, both in terms of financial wealth, but also knowledge wealth and creative wealth. But I also relish in the fact that there are certain things you will never know about this, because of the ways that hair is also about intimacy, interiority, and Black life, mm-hmm. and Black life lived on Black lives' terms.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that so much. Thank you. Yeah, y'all can clap all the time. It's fine. Listen, I live for affirmation. But Avery, you know, adding a little bit on to what Dr. Lindsay is saying, you know, when you think about it, there's so much that people say are trends when it comes to Black hair, instead of traditions and in the deep, you know, intimacy and spirituality of it. What do we lose when people just reduce things to trends versus it being a tradition for us in culture?
Well, honestly, I think that, and also good afternoon, everybody. Hi. But I feel like it allows people to erase our history and our traditions when we lean into that, because it's, that's the point. The Eurocentric nature and all of the things that we went through to get here. And I'm not, it's nothing about anybody's particular place right now. I'm talking about that journey that we went through. That's, y'all know what I'm talking about, where we had to have our hair straightened and we had to appear certain ways. And if your hair was curly and kinky, it was not right. But that is who we are. And we're basically bleaching it out of ourselves, right? And so that is, for me, that's what it is. It's erasure. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I've had a variety of hairstyles. Don't get me wrong. And I took that whole journey. And then there was a period of time where, sorry, I rebuked the idea of giving all my money to barbers and beauticians. I just rebuked it, and I started cutting my own hair. And then there came a point where, well, I met somebody, and she has the skill set necessary to do this, and is my loctician, right? And that's part, when we talk about the journey, and like, my beauty salon is the living room, actually. But this is part of her history, my history, and every, like, there's so many, like, even when we're thinking about the idea of dreads versus locks, like, mm-hmm. who put that on us, mm-hmm. right? They're locks. I mean, you call it what you want. You call it what you want, but they're locks, people. dreaded, there are negative connotations to that, because, again, they're trying to put stuff on us and erase our history. Mm-hmm.
That's so powerful. You know, Sarai, I'm going to come to you because, you know, again, I want to know a little bit more of how you started in your salon, because one of the things that Avery just said is the living room and the kitchen is where I have the most memories of hair, especially grandma getting ready for church, that fried dye laid to the side. If you know, you know. And so I just remember, even in anytime you sweat, you smell the burn. Listen, who knows what I'm talking about? Listen. You already know. You already know. So when you think about, you know, the salon and what it represents beyond just the hair and beauty, can you talk to us about that journey a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Good morning or good afternoon, everyone. I definitely resonate with the living room because that's where I started. I started right in my bedroom. I was in LA, Altadena area, braiding hair. I would braid hair in my high school, things like that. And then I grew further and further, put the knowledge to it and turned it into a legitimate business. And so within the salon, I was like, how can I curate this space to feel like how I felt when I was at home? I want it to feel comfortable. I wanted people to be able to come in and let their hair down. And I think that is what the salon truly represents. The ability for Black women to come in and they don't got a code switch. They can just exhale, and it's therapeutic. It's healing. And beyond that, I think it's its own ecosystem. For me, growing up, seeing my mom get braids and different professional women get silk presses or locks or wear their fro and things like that, I was like, oh wow, I can be in these spaces and still look like that. So I was able to feel confident that when I grow up, you know, I can either curate this or be a member of it. So I think that's what my salon represents. It's training people to be leaders and building independence and ownership.
I love that so much about leadership. You know, that's a beautiful thing. So for those of you who don't spend a lot of time in the salon, that was the original therapist. We tell them all our business. They probably know more than our spouses know. Listen, those are facts. But when you think about that, there is an empowerment that goes along with that. And so as a part of the hair journey, you are building a different way that you are coming out and leading in your own life. So I love that so much. You know, and Representative Brandt, you know, one of the things I think about, you know, was mentioned earlier, in a lot of cases when Black women are in corporate situations and executive roles, you know, how they wear their hair has been a determinant of their upward mobility in a lot of ways. So when you think about a hair journey where the policies and the systems are actually the antithesis to growth, you know, how do we address that? And how does that show up in real life when you think about those things?
Well, for everyone who doesn't know me, I'm Juanita Brenn. I just happen to be a state representative from the Cleveland area, and I'm so glad to be here. I'm going to get to the question real quick, but for those who have not sat around them, their energy is amazing. Like, just, it's amazing. So I'm really more glad that I'm sitting in their presence than maybe, but I'm so glad just to be here. But we see it show up in the workplace. I'll just tell you about an incident situation that happened about 7 years ago at the State House when I hired my first staffer. He had a curly mohawk. His hair grew in very curly, very tight, and he had his hair shaved on the side. And one of my colleagues, who is still in the State House, walked up to him and said, "That's not gonna get you far in life wearing your hair like that." Say that directly to him, to his face. He walks over to me, because this is really like his first job. And he told me what the older gentleman who is lacking melanin in his life said to him. And I walked over to my colleague, who is now a state senator. He's on leadership, bless him. But long story short, I just said, you can't define what professionalism is. Because he is a professional every day. When he shows up to work on time, he does his work. He is a professional every day.
That's right.
So these conversations of how it shows up is also standing up for people or standing up for yourself when people are trying to define how you should look in these different spaces. And that we have to also say something. Like, we can't just sit back and just be like, oh, I'm not going to say anything when things like that happen, because I feel like those are those power struggles that people are having. And because we don't have laws that protect people, this is why I introduced the Crown Act, because if people cannot legally have any recourse, if somebody says that your hair is not professional, showing up to work in its natural state.
And could you honestly just elaborate just a little bit more on the Crown Act for those of you who are not aware of what the Crown Act is, please?
Yes. So the Crown Act basically is saying right now here in the state of Ohio, it is legal for someone to discriminate against your hair in its natural state. If you're wearing braids, puffs, locks, they can legally discriminate against you. Like, you would not have any recourse if your job said, hey, I want you to straighten your hair, I don't want you wearing your hair in braids. There's no legal recourse in the state of Ohio if you wanted to sue. And so in that situation with my aide, he legally would not be able to do anything. He would not be able to have any legal recourse in a state if you wanted to, unless we change the laws.
I want y'all to sit with that for a second. How people's hair naturally grows out of their head is illegal in some places. I mean, we talk about illegality in terms of laws, but people can't be illegal. I'm gonna tell you that right now. I say it out loud. People cannot be illegal. And so much of the themes of this particular play is around immigration and what does it mean to be a new American? What does it mean to be American citizen? And what is citizenship? And what is patriotism looking like, right? And so when you think about that, I think about this so much that these words honestly were written in 2019. And when you literally pick this play up and put it in today and what is happening. And we're watching that happen in real time. You know, so I wanna ask back to Representative Brent for a minute. You know, when you think about legislation that is written that actually does not give life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all, what is expected of us as citizens in this state, in this city, in this world, to stand up against those things that have systemically been put in front of us as barriers?
We have to be consistent and stand up. And we're just going to deal with a basic situation. I live in Cleveland, but most of the people that's in this room lives in Columbus. By a raise of hands, how many people have actually been to the State House? How many people, keep your hand up if you've actually testified at the State House? You see how many hands dropped? Thank you, good sis, for testifying. So we have to show up, but then we also have to make sure that we are applying pressure by testifying, because that helps folks like myself when we are testifying for a bill that's good, like the Crown Act, which I hope you testify for, or against other problematic bills that are at the State House. We have to be consistent, because what will happen is that people say, well, no one testified. We had a very problematic bill that was in education, and no one came and testified. Even the unions were scared to testify because they were scared of the repercussions.
And to speak to this idea of illegality and what we mean, I want to also invite us to consider what that means in terms of who gets criminalized for the ways that our humanity shows up. So it's not only that your colleague wouldn't be able to go to a court of law and to object to this treatment, it's that he's profiled because of it. There are assumptions that are made about that. We know that black hair ties into criminalization, racial profiling, brutality at its worst. And so I think we have to be very clear that what we're talking about is how anti-blackness shows up. And anti-blackness shows up in the policing of how we can and cannot wear our hair. That saying our hair in its natural state is not professional is also saying in a not so subtle way that how you show up is not fully human in the way that we want you to show up. Mm-hmm. It is a dehumanizing condition. And I think we have to talk about it with that level of gravity and with that level of seriousness, which makes a bill like this so important. But then also thinking about the cultural resonances of that. So it also impacts how our babies are treated in their classrooms, based on how they're perceived, based on how you walk down a street, or if something happens, who's presumed to be a guilty party. And that's from head to toe when it comes to blackness, but the hair plays a significant role in that. So it is about changing the law, but it is also about a fundamental shift in culture in the ways that anti-blackness shows up.
Absolutely. Thank you for adding that, Dr. Lindsay. So, Sarai, I'm going to come to you. And it's a two-part question for you and Avery, especially because Avery, in your role as the executive director of the Central Ohio African-American Chamber, when you think about black women's labor, and especially when it comes to the beauty industry, right? You know, there's so much more labor intense that we do, and ownership is a lot less. But when you think about what it looks like to be an entrepreneur, especially in the hair business, so Rai, like, what has been some of the greatest victories you felt like you've had, and what are some of the biggest challenges that you've encountered? And then Avery, I want you to follow up with that question, is what you are noticing in terms of how businesses are supported and funded in the regular world, until places like Freedom Equity and COACC comes into play?
I would say when it comes to braiding specifically, which is my expertise, it's something that it's like innately given to us as black women. Like, a lot of us just know how to braid. And oftentimes in cosmetology schools, braiding is not taught. So there's no regulation. There's no, you know, way that we're supposed to create a business out of it. So I think that was the hardest struggle. It's like, okay, where can I go to do this legitimately? So I had to pull on resources. I had to really get out there and anchor my craft with lawyers, accountants, financial advisors, to really understand how to legitimize my business and create systems. A lot of times you know, we have that hustle mentality, and there's nothing wrong with hustling, but at the same time, if we don't have systems, then it leads to burnout. And a lot of what I've learned as I've grown is setting boundaries, being in alignment and not being afraid to say no to certain things. My dad always tells me that, you know, all money ain't good money. So you gotta, you know, you gotta be discerning and move forward in order to create progress.
Yeah, so in my roles every day, for those of you who I don't know, I work every day to support Black business. So either with education, advocacy, access to capital, and access to contracts. So we have the African-American Chamber, and then we have Freedom Equity, which provides working capital term loans to small businesses in Central Ohio. And so every day we get to hear and see the struggles of the businesses that we interact with. And it's the challenge is never lack of talent. Never. That is not the challenge. The challenge is usually related to lack of exposure to business management techniques and processes like Sarai was just mentioning. But then also, you can get everything in order, and go to a bank who you may have had a relationship with personally, professionally, as a business for many years, and you don't have a relationship with them when it comes down to it, because you apply for capital and they don't see you and they deny you and they probably will not speak to you. Because when we have seen, there have been ghosts, what are they called when they go into the stores? Secret shoppers. They have secret shopped multiple large scale financial institutions with financials, apples to apples, two business enterprises. The only thing different is the race of the business owners. And one is 60% more likely to get denied than the other one. I wonder who that might be, right? And so that is a pre-existing thing. Another thing to keep in mind is that when we're specifically thinking about Black women are like the highest educated demographic in the United States. We are also the highest debt-laden group in the United States because we also have a lot of student loan debt. A lot of us are heads of household, meaning we're taking care of other people, and some of that doesn't show up in our net worth. None of it shows up in our net worth. And then speaking of our net worth, we're already making less on the dollar than everybody else. When we do get access to credit cards, it's for a lower limit than anybody else. And then we have higher utilization because we got bills to pay. And then your utilization brings down your credit score. So then when you come to apply for financing, your credit score might be too low to get financing. That is what we deal with. So Freedom Equity was created to be an alternative. We're a community development financial institution that provides low interest, affordable, accessible term loans. And the idea is that credit score shouldn't really be a determining factor. 550 is our minimum credit score. We have seen people come below that. So what do we start doing? Financial literacy. We started adding programming and business development services around it. So maybe it's not right now, but come back, right? And work with our team, work with our coaches and figure out how to grow your business and then come back and get some capital from us. And then go work with us and other people. Go to Adelphi, go to Huntington, go to PNC, go to whomever. Use it as a stair step. But the idea is we need more people. My staff is 100% Black. My board is 100% Black. We need more people that can commiserate and understand and can like give people a chance. And so that's why our organizations exist.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that. Yes, absolutely. Please. So, you know, one of the things we talk a lot about is how popular Black culture is in all the world globally. And it is consumed at a high rate, yet Black women are rarely protected in those same spaces. And a lot of times we've seen what we call appropriation versus appreciation. And I would love, Dr. Lindsay, if you could expound a little bit on what that actually looks like and how do we actually move away from appropriation to accountability?
Ooh, okay. It's like y'all got some time today. So, you know, appropriation and appreciation, and I've noticed this discussion is much more complicated in talking through this with folks, what folks feel appreciated by, what we co-sign in public, we'll see someone doing something that we've identified as part of Black culture. And again, Black culture here is just a stand-in for a whole bunch of things. So I want to be clear about that. There's no monolith of what Black culture is, and it is an abundance of genius that shows up in so many places. But you see some, and then someone can do a dance that a Black person has choreographed or done, and they will go viral. And they will end up on late night talk shows and become a whole sensation. And the creator of that very same thing will have very little access to any of those opportunities. So it's not just an appropriation question. There is a literal loss of creative wealth that happens. And also, some of the things that we create are criminalized on us and celebrated on others. So the way that someone can do have their hair or nails done, and there are so many ways that Black girls, Black femmes are policed if they got color in their hair, long nails that exaggerated out here. And then you'll see it show up on a runway somewhere, and it'll be seen as high fashion, haute couture. And that same woman, femme who had presented herself in that way, is seen as unemployable, as someone who is difficult to work with, and someone who probably is up to no good. And so when I think about the argument about appropriation versus appreciation, I think there's all kinds of collaborative opportunities with Black culture. And I think Black people are some of the most inviting people in the world in terms of learning from and engaging with and spreading this. I mean, so much of US culture is rooted in what Black people do, what Black people cook, what Black people say. Gen Z slang is nothing but Black speak, Black queer speak more specifically. And so we know that that's happening. How do you then change the conversation from simply saying, this is really cool, to this is cool, and I want to get to that content creator. I want to get to that artist. I want to talk to the person who, or the communities that helped develop this, so we can get some eyes on here. That's where we want that recognition. But again, we're so quick to invisibilize the humanity of Black folk, and so quick to understand that that creative wealth is so easily accessible without ever feeling like you have to pay back into it. So there's a larger discussion about reparations, but there's a really important discussion about creative reparations that I think also has to be had in terms of how we understand the architecture of the world as a creative place and how much of that has been built by Black, Indigenous, and marginalized folks that people feel entitled to it. It feels as though not only should it be free, but it should be more profitable for those outside of that community, because it's just something you'll do when you'll just create something else.
That's incredible. Please, Sarai.
Wanting to add on to that, I was thinking about within the entertainment industry, many of us are not sitting in those rooms in which they go over the script and create these styles. It's not us there. So when we look at a TV show, we're like, man, like why is her hair, you know, not up to par? It's because we're not in those rooms to do it. So I think for us to, you know, educating ourselves to be able to be in those rooms to make those decisions and put our imprint, because really it's our inheritance. This is, you know, the aesthetic of our hair, it's not a mood board. It's literally given to us to pass down and to show our creativity. So if they're gonna tap into our culture, we should be the ones hands-on.
100%, yes, please clap for that.
You're listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE, inspired by the Contemporary Theater of Ohio's upcoming performances of Jia Jia's African Hair Braiding. This week's forum explores the cultural and economic significance of African hair braiding and the stories woven into every style. Our panelists this week unpack how hair carries history, artistry, and identity. We're hearing from Ohio State House Representative Juanita Brent, braid artist and author Sarai Brooks, J. Avery Frost with the Central Ohio African American Chamber of Commerce, and Dr. Treva B. Lindsay with The Ohio State University. Your host is LaChandra Baker with LaChandra B. Baker Edutainment. We'll get back to this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, Braids, Business, and Belonging, Black Hair and Identity in Columbus, after a short break.
Hi there, this is Morgan James. Every album represents a step in an artist's journey. Hello, music lovers. I'm inviting you to listen to Music Journeys with Mike Foley. Mike mixes music and conversation with artists to share what informed and inspired their latest project, how the love of music began, what music means to them, and so much more. We've chatted about three of my projects, the most recent being Soul Remains the Same, a soul album of songs you would never expect. You can always expect the perfect combination of music and stories on Music Journeys. The show airs Saturday afternoons at 3:30 on WCBE. Recent episodes are available on the major podcast platforms and the WCBE app. To meet and hear more from all the musicians featured since its start in 2018, including me, to be the first to be featured three times on the show, look for Music Journeys on WCBE's podcast experience at WCBE.org.
Do you love amazing stories? I know I do. I'm Michael Kent, and every week on my show, we examine something from history that's so unbelievable it sounds made up, but is 100% verifiably true. It's a podcast called The Internet Says It's True, and there are hundreds of episodes to choose from. For example, did you know the story of how Leonard Nimoy came up with Live Long and Prosper for Star Trek? Or how Columbia is dealing with a hippo problem that goes back directly to Pablo Escobar? Or one of my favorite stories, a man figured out that a nondescript Winnebago being auctioned online was actually an important part of space exploration history. These are all stories from The Internet Says It's True. Listening to a podcast has never been easier. You can listen through any popular podcast app, through the NPR app, or download the fantastic new WCBE app, click the Podcasts tab, and look for The Internet Says It's True with Michael Kent. You'll have so many stories up your sleeve, you'll feel like the smartest person in the room, especially if you're home alone.
Welcome back to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. In Columbus, Black-owned braiding salons are places of entrepreneurship, cultural preservation, and community connection. Inspired by the Contemporary Theater of Ohio's upcoming performances of Dja Dja's African Hair Braiding, this week's forum explores the cultural and economic significance of African hair braiding and the stories woven into every style. Dja Dja's African Hair Braiding, written by Ohio State graduate Jocelyn Biot, follows West African women building lives inside a Harlem salon. Our panelists this week unpack how hair carries history, artistry, and identity. This week we welcome Ohio State House Representative Juanita Brent, Sarai Brooks, braid artist, author, and owner of Haven 626 by Rye Styles, J. Avery Frost, Executive Director of the Central Ohio African American Chamber of Commerce, and Dr. Treva B. Lindsay, Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at The Ohio State University. Your host is LaChandra Baker, founder and lead consultant with LaChandra B. Baker Edutainment. Let's get back to this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, Braids, Business, and Belonging, Black Hair and Identity in Columbus.
So Representative Brent, you know, I have to imagine, you know, as a Black woman in, you know, the government of, you know, any executive branch, it's very hard to see people who look like you, number one, in that space, and to know that many laws are created not with women centered and not with women in mind. When you take your charge and do your job every single day, how do you help shift that narrative where women can become more centered in these laws because they're actually the ones holding up neighborhoods and communities?
So that's always a good question. I told my caucus, I belong to the minority caucus, that Black women are the conscience of the state house. And so when things are happening in committee rooms, there's always at least one Black woman on each committee. It's definitely by design by our caucus to make sure that at least one of the Black women are on the committees, because we become the conscience of the committee hearing. And because the things of accountability that we know that, and I hate to put that burden on us Black women, but we're gonna look out for everybody. If nobody looks out for everybody, the Black woman on a committee is gonna look out for everybody. She's also gonna make sure that there's amendments that are there to say like, hey, this bill can be problematic. How can we do less damage to hurt less people? How can we make sure that more people are accommodated for? And so they become the conscience of the whole state house. And you've seen that over and over again. If you look at Congresswoman Joyce Beatty when she was the minority leader at the state house and everything that she did to increase the numbers of people who came there, or Congresswoman Amelia Sykes when she was there, they became the conscience of the state house while they were there. And you can just keep on naming so many more Black women who were very intentional about even laws that they introduced about making sure that it's illegal to domestic violence when it comes to dating someone. You become the conscious. And so we have to be very intentional about who we are having in the room, and that you are not just there, but you are being the conscious of accountability of actions. So that's always my purpose when I'm in the room, is to speak up.
I appreciate that. That's usually all of our jobs, right? Every room I've ever been, they'll be like, "La, say it," and I will, but still somebody else can say it too, right? Sarai, for you, what is sustainability as a Black entrepreneur? What does that look like for you?
I would say really being intentional about my business, having a business plan. Many of us, you know, may not have seen entrepreneurship in our home. So really learning what that is and sticking to that plan. And then knowing our value and not being afraid to charge our worth, and keeping up with the economy right now. We're dealing with a big tariffs issue, and choosing whether to eat the cost or put it onto our clients. That's a heavy load, because sometimes even our clients, you know, can't afford to pay more, and we want to service them. So we have to kind of levy that. So it's keeping up to date and knowledgeable with all of the access we have, and using those tools and implementing them into our business so that the systems that we have are automated and we're not burning out, like I mentioned before, setting those clear boundaries, and really using our community to build. So often we feel like we have to do things on our own, and like, you know, I'm a lone wolf. I'm a rise to the top by myself. No, we can build together. We see law firms with three different last names. Why can't we do that together as Black women?
Yes, love that. Absolutely. Thank you for that so much, Sarai. So it is CMC's longstanding tradition that we take audience questions. And so this is where we get interactive. So we're gonna move from questions from our live stream and in-person audiences in just a few minutes. So remember, communication is a two-way street. And if you have a question for our panelists, now is the perfect time for you, if you're in the room, to head to the microphone to my left. And if you are on the live stream, you can type it into the chat. And so before we turn it over to Doug in the audience, I have one more question for each of you. So thinking about, in your perspective, industries and where you stand, what is one action that people listening online and in this room can do today to further advance the appreciation, respect, and valuing of Black women? That's right, it's heavy. That's what I do. We can start with.
I think a very easy thing you can do that costs you no money is be more respectful. I hope this lady watching, I was driving in, I don't know her name, so I can't call her out by name, but she knows me. I pulled into the Wendy's yesterday to get me some lunch. I'm hungry. And for no reason, this woman, who does not resemble me in any way, slow walks herself, glaring at me across, and then gets onto the sidewalk and then glares at me and catches my eye so she can see me glaring at her. I had to think of my mother and all my ancestors, because I was almost arrested in the Wendy's on South High Street. So what I would say is just be more respectful, please. Like, we're people too, and we're always the caretakers. We're always making sure that people are good, but y'all are really not making sure that we're good. And that's all I got.
I'll go next. And it made me almost cry when you said that, because the first thing that came to my mind is showing up for Black women in these different spaces as an ally. And even sometimes Black women need to learn to show up for themselves. But it's a lot of strength to keep showing up every day, every day. And sometimes we might be the only one in the room. We might have somebody else in the room that they might not be where we are. Mentally, of how they need to show up for themselves, but show up for us, because we're sometimes tired of being the strong one of the group. And I get back to what I said about being on a committee where it was intentional effort to make sure that there's always one Black woman on a committee. That's meaning also you might be by yourself being a conscious. So it's you showing up for us in the State House by testifying in support of what we're doing goes a long way.
I would say sharing a wealth of knowledge, investing in us both financially or with just knowledge. And then for us on the other side of it, being teachable, willing to learn. I feel like sometimes we don't have the game. We don't know how to, you know, do this. So if you know, tell us, share with us.
Awesome, thank you.
I love all of these. These are very helpful. I would just say all of us are in different rooms, coming in from different places. I encourage us in that room when you see stuff to call it out, to not, like, I know there's a lot of risk in calling out or calling in or addressing a thing, but it's important that even when a Black woman isn't in the room, that you are thinking about the Black women who should be in that room.
Right.
And the Black women who have never had access to that room. It is very important that we move with a kind of conscience. As the representative mentioned, that when they say Black women are the conscience in the room, it makes me think of Combahee River collective statement, when Black women get free, we all get free, which means we have to address all of these different forms of oppression and marginalization, injustice and inequity. And so if you think about how is this gonna impact the most marginalized person that I know, and if you move with decision-making or giving or opportunity-making or space-making, think about who that is. And quite often that is Black women. But think about who that is and make sure you are trying to be a voice that is aligned with them. Not speaking for people, but aligned with and an allyship and comradeship with those folks.
Yes. Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So we're gonna turn it over to all of you now, and Doug has the questions, and so I'm gonna throw it to you, Doug. Thank you so much.
Law, thank you so much. Thank you so much to today's panelists for a powerful conversation. And I'm sorry for those of you joining us on our live stream. We had some technical issues today, but we're working on that now. So please bear with us online. If you have a question for today's panelists, please do join us here at the microphone. We'll try to get to as many questions as we can. Great questions at CMC always have two things in common. They can be asked in 30 seconds or less. And what punctuation mark does a question always end with? Elizabeth? A question mark. That's correct. That's right. I'm going to launch us off with this one. And this was submitted by Julie Barrett. And this builds on several comments that several of you have made. How does our hair affect the change in culture regarding diversity and inclusion? Does this hurt or help us secure employment?
Firstly, I hate it here sometimes, like in this place, because it shouldn't matter. Like, we know that your hair, as we've heard, it really shouldn't matter. Your natural state should not matter. And I need more of us who are in power and decision-making positions to make sure you really set the culture in your organizations and your workplaces so people feel safe. Because there are places where you will have challenge, especially knowing what we know and we heard today, that you can be discriminated against because of your hair in the state of Ohio. There are people who may have lost their jobs since over the last year and a half. There are people who will lose their jobs. And so as private employers, as public spaces, the city is a great place to work and stuff. Just make sure that people know that they're safe. Yep.
And I was just gonna say, our hair doesn't need to be managed. It grows out perfectly how it should, and the way we style it doesn't define us professionally. Our professionalism comes from our skill, our etiquette, our education, all of those things combined, and how we wear our hair is just how we show up for ourselves.
Good morning, ladies. Real quick, this does end in a period, but thank you all for everything that you do. I'm so appreciative. I consider myself a legacy Black. I proudly stand on the shoulders of my ancestors who've carried me here. While I try really hard not to act entitled, I also want to make sure that I progress our purpose, our cause, our resistance. But I want to do that without being the meal of the world. It is us as Black women who must do the consistent work of being the conscious and must do the consistent work of being beautiful in our own special way, but try really hard not to be devoured by the systems of this world. And I'm definitely an anti-burnout person. So please, do you have any advice for someone who is entitled, is legacy, but is trying really hard not to get eaten?
At the Say House, I'm gonna tell you what I did last night so I would not get burnt out. Me and all the Black women legislators got together for dinner. Most of the time we don't see each other during the day, and having people pour into you and reset you and love on you is a way to kind of make sure you don't deal with that burnout, because you have to show up as your best self. So making sure your cup is full, making sure you are having people pour into you every day. That person who can call you and be like, are you good? Did you eat today? Did you take your vitamins? Make sure you take your vitamin D, because we're deficient on that. It's very important in these spaces.
Yes, I love that. And I affirm the burnout. I feel like that's so much of what so many of us are navigating, and that choice to do that. Hence why you have folks like Trisha Hershey talking about rest is resistance, and rest is our inheritance as well. Joy is our inheritance as part of that. And I think part of that is I etch out time that's untouchable. That's about filling my cup. That's about filling my cup with convening with my sisters, that's convening with my folks, that's loving on me, that's taking a lavender and sea salt bath, that's really committed. I'm not talking about things that feel indulgent or also take time in planning and things, literal things that allow you to exhale, like a full, real exhale. And it gives me that very hackneyed kind of analogy of thinking about on the plane. They tell you, put your mask on first before you help others. Well, we are constantly taking our, not even putting our mask on and trying to put masks on everyone else. So I implore us to value our humanity in the same way that we're saying we want to be valued. I think I have to tell that message more often to Black women ourselves than even other folks. Like, you have to value you, your own humanity. You are your best steward of peace and exhale.
Thank you.
Erin Arnett on the live stream audience says, I am a white woman, but mentor a young Black girl. How can I best love and support her?
I was gonna say, my salon is in Dublin, Ohio. And Dublin, Ohio. And I often run into white mothers with their Black daughters, whether they're mixed or adopted. And one thing I love is they ask me so many questions. They're willing to be educated about how to style their hair, how to help them love their hair. We don't have to be ignorant and just, let them go to school, but like make them feel good, make them feel worthy of being there. So
I'll give a shameless plug, and I saw her walk in. Sister Fran Fraser is here in the room, but she founded a great organization. She founded a great organization called Black Girl Rising, and they're right here. Yeah, woo woo, BGR. I would encourage that question asker, I apologize, whomever, to really make sure she's investing her time and make sure that young girl can invest her time in spaces where she feels safe and with peers. And that organization, they do a lot of great peer-to-peer work, which I really appreciate. And so I think that would be a good resource.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. It's so good to see you here. My question was actually similar to Erin's, as I'm a woman who grew up in a white family. It took me 35 years to walk into a Black hair store, let alone be able to really embrace the power of braids. But I'm going to move on. That ends with a period. A good question. So we're going to, or a semicolon. A good question ends with a question mark. I'm going to ask of Rep. Brent. We see in the State House some movement on legislation, but we've got a lot of women across the state of Ohio in our most local offices who are facing similar discriminatory action. So what advice would you give to our most local elected officials, school boards, city councils, township trustees, women, Black women who want to stand up and represent and impact their local community, and how to show up and how to be able to make sure that their voice is being heard in this love for others?
Thank you for that question. When I first ran for office, everyone told me to straighten my hair. And I realized I was not authentic to myself. Being authentic to yourself will allow you to get up and have peace with how you show up in those different places. For those who are local electeds, pass the Crown Act. Pass it for the kids in your school that do not have any legal recourse. And show up as your authentic self, if it's in locks and braids, because people appreciate you more, way more, when you show up as yourself. when you are comfortable in your own skin. And if you're still trying to figure it out, find some people around you that can pour into you, or you keep telling yourself till you start believing it. But we have to show up as our authentic self. And to this day, I met a candidate just recently, Black woman, who went and got this weave. Hey, if you want a weave, hey, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with getting a weave. But it was the reason why she got the weave that bothered me. She told me some folks in her community told her that her naturally very curly, beautiful hair was not gonna help her get elected, and that she needed to go get a weave. And they went and found her somebody to go get the weave. And now she's running for state rep. Very problematic. Show up as yourself and let people deal with the rest. That's their problem, not yours.
That's facts. Jonna, please.
Hi. I was wondering, so from my perspective, or just some context on my perspective, I grew up in predominantly white areas pretty much my whole life, and comfortably so, but also feel very comfortable being around Black people more so, really. And I'm noticing that the act of building a community that looks like me and believes like me is like something I have to actually devote time to. Can you guys speak to how to do that? How to find that community?
Good question. First of all, I think at Columbus, it is increasingly hard to do that. We were talking about this at our table. A lot of people have been moving to Columbus. We're more of a city of implants than we are a city of natives at this point. So it can be hard. And it doesn't always feel like there's physical spaces where you can just like go to in our organic conversations. And so honestly, for me, the best path has been, and I am a native, but the best path for me has been to be in professional associations. Right. And of course, our Chamber of Commerce. And yes, you have to pay to be in some of those things, but I'm choosing to pay my dollars to something where I know there are probably like-minded individuals. And then like organically, you'll start meeting people, having different friendships, and you'll build your tribe, right? And then, but also they say as you get older, it's harder to meet people, I guess. That's just the thing they say. I don't know who they is. But I think it's just intentionality, like coming to stuff like this, going to networking events, and really just like spreading your wings. If you're spiritual, going to church and Bible study, right? Like just kind of, I guess, especially since COVID is gone, apparently, it's about getting out again. Yeah.
I would just add to that, there are spaces here because I think a lot of people have a similar kind of feeling and an inclination and searching for community. And I do believe post at least lockdown surrounding COVID, finding those social skills of interacting and getting back with each other is not the easiest thing, right? There's a natural kind of, ooh, I gotta anchor myself. It is a lot of events happening all of the time. I think of places like Zora's House here in Columbus, which is a woman of color, gender expansive people of color space that's centered with all kinds of programming. I'd love to holler at you after to give you some suggestions of places where to connect. I'm not a Columbus native, but you do have to be very intentional. I started getting a little more comfortable again with me and going to things and events that were smaller, not necessarily like a large party, but this person's coming to speak at this event and sitting down by myself, because chances are someone in there who's coming to that same event might have a similar interest or a similar political system or beliefs or values, and just saying, hey. So it does take a little bit of bravery, but keep in mind that all of us are kind of scared who are doing that. So you gonna find that other scared person who's doing that, and then y'all can be scared together, right? Which feels a lot better. Like that first step of saying, here are these things, but there are spaces and you are not alone. And I wanna affirm that feeling though of trying to find community, because it is an intentional praxis and one that is a skill set of how you create community, that we can be more gracious with each other about doing that work too.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Treva.
We have 2 minutes for one short final question.
Okay, please.
Hi, you said the Crown Act was not enacted in Ohio earlier. That's concerning for me as somebody who has recently gotten locks, and they're really important to me. And the fact that some schools aren't enforcing that is concerning. So what do you think citizens can do to like help get the Crown Act enacted in Ohio? And how did you evolve into the people you are? Because you guys are so cool and inspiring.
I appreciate the compliment, but I'm gonna start off with my biggest hater, the Ohio Chamber. They came out in opposition to the bill because they felt like it would be very problematic for businesses within the state of Ohio. Imagine you doing a bill and you have the Ohio Chamber, which most businesses are part of, and they come out in opposition of it strongly, like big guns in the committee room against it. So we first got to address our haters. Please shout out to the Ohio Chamber and let them know that we want to pass the Crown Act in the state of Ohio.
Vigilance, vigilance, vigilance. Be a thorn in their sides and keep with your beautiful welcome to the Lockstar journey. It is a beautiful journey. Your hair is beautiful and we got your back. So I think it is also the commitment of the folks in this room, the folks online, the folks who will watch this later to remain that we got each other in this and we're going to continue to fight for this. So you are not alone and that beautiful hair will be in any room you want to be in.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That is unfortunately all the time we have for today. And I'm going to welcome Sophia to close us out. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. Inspired by the Contemporary Theater of Ohio's upcoming performances of Dja Dja's African Hair Braiding, this week's forum explored the cultural and economic significance of African hair braiding and the stories woven into every style. Our panelists this week unpacked how hair carries history, artistry, and identity. This week we welcomed Ohio State House Representative Juanita Brent, braid artist and author Sarai Brooks, J. Avery Frost with the Central Ohio African American Chamber of Commerce, and Dr. Treva B. Lindsay with The Ohio State University. Your host was LaChandra Baker with LaChandra B. Baker Edutainment. Our forum partner this week was the Contemporary Theater of Ohio. The presenting sponsor of our live stream was the Center for Human Kindness at the Columbus Foundation. Our live stream partner was the Columbus Dispatch. This forum was also supported by Downtown Columbus Incorporated and the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. If you'd like to keep exploring this week's forum topic, our friends at the Columbus Metropolitan Library recommend reading Twisted, The Tangled History of Black Hair Culture by Emma DeBeery. Join us next week as the not-for-profit Columbus Metropolitan Club once again connects people and ideas through community conversations. I hope you'll join us. I'm Doug Buchanan. Thanks for listening.